Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the most interesting and dynamic parts of that war, of course, is in the Middle East. And I'm very pleased to say our first guest is a man I've just met by the name of Taseer Abu Saada, who hails from there. His personal history is quite interesting. He experienced growing up a call to wage jihad against Israel and, for that matter, hostility, I think, towards the United States as well. He's come quite a long way, however, in terms of both his personal trajectory and his life's work. And we have a chance to visit with him briefly about the subject of his two books, Once an Arafat Man, and Mind of Terror. And I'm very pleased to say, Tass, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is going to be a very brief introduction, and I look forward to having a much longer visit with you soon. But thank you for taking a few minutes to join us. It's good to meet you.
Frank, thank you very much for inviting me to your show.
Thank you. Well, you grew up in this area known as Gaza, the Palestinian controlled area adjacent to Israel, very much set on creating a homeland for yourself and your fellow Palestinians. Tell us quickly about your experience with Yasser Arafat and your waging, as I say, jihad on behalf of Palestine.
Yeah, I was born in Gaza, but my family immigrated to Saudi Arabia when I was 2 months old. So I grew up in Saudi Arabia and in Qatar as a Palestinian immigrant and refugee, which I hated very much because we were demeaned because of that all the time. So at the age of 16 and a half, I joined Yasser Arafat forces to fight for my homeland. I wanted to be free of being called an immigrant and refugee. So I joined Arafat as a fighter and eventually grew in the ranks. The anger and hatred towards Israel was showing in the battlefield and was noticed by the leaders. So I was promoted. Eventually become an assassin for a short period of time that I did not really like very much. I did not feel comfortable. So I made my way out to America to study. I thought maybe that's my answer for a homeland is to have more education. And that's when I came here in 1974 and realized and surprised, to be honest, how kind the American people were to me, where I learned that Americans hated us and America. But I found out the difference when I came, and that's when I made my way to stay in America, decided to live here.
Yeah, and over the years, you became quite successful as an entrepreneur in the United States. You also converted to Christianity, as I understand it. Talk a little bit about that experience, and in particular, the project that you founded to help others do the same.
In 1993, through a relationship that God have created between me and a friend who passed away a couple of years ago, named Charlie Sharp, and was telling me about Jesus being the Son of God and He's God, and I totally rejected that idea. That's a blasphemy. So he read to me from John 1:1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Suddenly I'm shaking, and I lost conscience. The next time I'm on my knees on the floor, with my hands inviting Jesus to be my Lord and Savior. There is no way I would do that naturally. But it was the power of God and the Word that become alive and brought me down to my knees. I was looking at a light that was speaking to me as unconscious, speaking to a light. That's what Charlie told me. I was speaking to a light, to somebody, but he didn't see who I was seeing. I was speaking to a light that was saying, I am Jesus, I am the way, the truth, and the life. I didn't see Jesus' face. I just saw a powerful light. And that transformed my life totally. I realized I wasn't saved just to be a Christian, especially because of my background and what I have done in my past. I wanted to make a difference, to bring peace and reconciliation between Arabs and Jews. And that's been the drive all of my life for the last 25 years.
And the group that you have founded for this purpose is called Hope for Ishmael. Tell us a little bit about it and the work that you're about in connection with it.
The Lord has given us the vision, my wife and I, of Hope for Ishmael. I realized that the only way we're going to find peace in Israel and for the Jews and for the Arabs, the Palestinians in particular, is through Ishmael. Ishmael is the father of the Arab people, the Ishmaelites, and I'm an Ishmaelite. And so by reaching out to Arabs in particular, Muslims in general, and bringing them the conversion and the experience that I have received that transformed my heart to love Israel and the Jews passionately after hating them passionately. And you know, this is not some man can do. No way. Not in my hatred and passionate hatred for Israel and the Jews. Now I'm passionately loving Israel and the Jews. As a matter of fact, we're talking about peace between our Palestinians and Israelis. And this is a subject that have been going on, or a fight that have been going on for the last 4,200 years. It's not something new. And I came to understand that through the Bible, through studying the Bible, realizing that really the answer for that is salvation to the Palestinians and the understanding of the Jews that they have also the right to that land. And I, to be honest with you, I don't believe in the two-state solution. I believe it, one state, Israel, for both to live equally and justly, just as God created it to be. If we look at Ezekiel 47, you will find the answer right there.
Tass, we are going to have to come back to this in greater detail with you. I appreciate very much this very short primer on your fascinating personal journey, as well as your insights into what it will take to have peace in the Holy Land and the importance of achieving it. Dinah West joins us next. We'll talk a bit about the President's State of the Union address and the hard left and the challenge to American greatness that it represents right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined as we are privileged to be each week by Dinah West, one of our country's preeminent thinkers about and commentators upon what is the undercurrent, if you will, in our society, our politics, our culture, our history, even, as it bears on the national security as well as the common security of our people in the face of enemies, foreign and domestic. She is the author, of course, of two terrific books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. You can find her writings at dianawest.net, among other places, the Daily Caller as well. She is a regular here, and we're always grateful for the chance to catch up with her, but most especially in the aftermath of what I thought was a bravura performance by the president in the State of the Union address. Dianna West, welcome back. Let's talk a little bit about it.
Yes, happy to. It was exhilarating.
It was. It was indeed. What did you find particularly exhilarating about what the president said?
There were so many fantastic points that he got across, but there was something that set the speech apart in a way that I believe is historic. I'm actually doing some research on this. I refer, of course, to his vow that America would never become a socialist country. This was really an epic moment. I don't believe that a president has ever addressed the Congress and discussed socialism in a domestic context. In other words, we've heard speech after speech over the Cold War, over the last century, about the fear of communism and socialism abroad, somewhere else, someplace we sent troops, someplace we supported allies, and so on, far from our shores. And getting to this point of a domestic threat from within the chamber of the Congress, speaking directly to representatives who are openly advocating and pressing on plans to rapidly socialize America, the economy, through various means, was a very epic moment. It was a kind of showdown, but it was also, in that incredible Trump way, it was illuminating a threat that the media, that the people, that the politicians are loath to put in clear terms for the people to understand. And so this, to me, was a precious moment in American history, and he handled it with mastery and clarity.
Well, I'm glad you feel that, as I did. He is connecting the dots between the most recent predations of the socialists, now in evidence in the destruction, it's the only way to describe it, of the country of Venezuela, as the backdrop, the sort of context in which we have a choice to make, not just to greatness, but to avoid a similar fate, which Dianna West, as you have done so much to document over the years, is not a one-off in Venezuela. It's not an accident. It's not that they were not faithfully applying the practices of socialism, as the president said, I think, in a previous State of the Union address, if I'm not mistaken, it's that they performed exactly as socialism dictated, and that's the problem. And hence, when he said, quote, America was founded on liberty and independence, not government coercion, domination, and control. We're born free, and we will stay free. Tonight, we renew our resolve that America will never be a socialist country, unquote. It was, as you say, an epic throwdown. And we'll be talking more shortly with our colleague and friend Trevor Loudon about some of the people that were very much in the view of the cameras in response to those comments and who were not happy about it. But just in terms of what the president is confronting at the moment, he made another point that's, I think, not unrelated, and that is that he was talking about the kinds of opportunities that beckon us, the kinds of things that can be done. And he warned that if Congress, particularly the Democrats in the House, choose instead to wage effectively war against him through these endless investigations, that opportunity will be missed, and we will see, you know, a real disservice to the interests of the American people as a result. Talk a little bit about that, Dianna, and particularly the impetuses behind it, as you understand them.
Yes, well, he was speaking specifically about the investigation he said we could have legislation or investigation. We could have war, we could have peace. I mean, this was the dichotomy that he presented, and it was a very brilliant political stroke because it suddenly reframed these endless investigations of special counsel and what we're looking forward to in the Democratic-controlled House with these investigations continuing. It really put the onus on the Democrats, on the special counsel, for essentially stalling the people's work, stalling the engine of the country with these investigations that are political hammers, you know, going at Trump himself to prevent the agenda that the American people voted for when they put him in office in 2016. This was another one of these key moments that I think will be sinking in over time, and I hope that he follows up with. Really brilliant politics, again, with the idea that against this larger backdrop, with the implementation of socialism that he referred to, that you mentioned regarding Venezuela, I would just like to point out, I believe that discussion, when he said, no, Venezuela implemented socialism faithfully, as did everywhere else where we see suffering and misery and broken countries, that was at the United Nations, where he has spoken like this before. Again, going back to this point, this was in America, where he is recognizing the socialist threat within the chamber of the Congress, within the Democrats, which have suddenly come out in a very Bolshevik way to announce themselves as socialists. If you go back to the tape, I mean, I think it's something we should be doing and save the faces, and I'm sure Trevor will be getting into this, the faces of a person like Bernie Sanders. When President Trump discussed Venezuela and the tolls of socialism, are priceless, but so revealing, because they were glowering, they were stony-faced, they didn't want to hear this, they didn't want the American people to hear this.
Diana, just to tie this together, one of the things that you have been writing about for some time now, and that we will be publishing shortly at the Center for Security Policy Press, is a monograph of your collections on the subject of how this ideological connection to the hard left, whether it's the, you know, the Russians or whether it's the Chinese or whether it's others, but it's the hard left, is now much in evidence in the community of people who are engaged in these investigations, who have been perpetrating them in the past under the guise of the FBI or the Department of Justice during the Obama administration, or more recently now in these Democratic-controlled committees in the Congress. Just very quickly, give us a sense of how that, you know, sort of socialist or even communist thrust is operating in this war against President Trump at the moment.
Yes. Well, as I understand it, Marx actually used the words interchangeably, communist and socialist. So we can grasp this as the enemy of liberty, the enemy of freedom. In this monograph, I actually argue that President Trump is our most anti-communist president ever. And this is the crux of the war against him from within. In the same monograph, I've tracked the ideological roots and in some ways the intellectual history of a number of the players inside the anti-Trump conspiracy. You find the hard left, you find mentors going back through the generations to the Frankfurt School, to the Communist Party, and so on, so that we can start to kind of put context into this internal effort to take down the president as not merely a power struggle. We all deal with power struggles in every political generation, but an ideological struggle inside America between the forces of the left, the socialists, and the forces of the anti-communists, which have never gone away. We don't tap that power anymore, but I think that President Trump is awakening that cause of liberty in those very terms, as we saw in the State of the Union. And so this just continues, and he just deserves all of our support in this struggle.
Yeah, he does. And I think it will be very interesting to watch how the Republican establishment responds. By and large, I think they were on their feet applauding him in the course of the State of the Union last night, including on some of these points about socialism. Indeed, I even saw Chuck Schumer jumping to his feet in response to the president's comment that we would not have a socialist country here. But this is one of those moments when I think Dinah West is, as you've understood so clearly, an enormous amount is on the line. And the American people will either rally to the president's side and achieve, I think, the greatness that that he's calling us to find in ourselves once again, or we will, you know, watch inexorably this steady descent into something akin to the kind of morass and really horror for the people and for the economy and for our freedoms that is all too much the hallmark of socialism wherever it has been tested and applied. Then we have to leave it at that for the moment. We'll be talking more with Trevor Loudon about this, of course, but I want to say thank you for, as always, your inspiring insights and great leadership, The Daily Caller, and of course at dinahwest.net. Thank you so much for joining us. Godspeed. We'll talk with you soon. Next up, Trevor Loudon, right after this.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined by a man who has for years been a fixture of this program, I'm pleased to say, always fascinating in terms of his insights about the challenge that we're facing. We talked a little bit about it earlier with Dinah West, but we're going to drill down in more detail on the problem of the enemy within. This is the topic of both a best-selling book and a documentary film by Trevor Loudon, our guest for this next segment. He is one of the world's preeminent authorities on the matters of socialism and communism, the ideologies, the organizational character, and the various manifestations, particularly in American domestic political life of those who espouse this radical Marxist-Leninist, anti-American agenda. Trevor Loudon, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. So good to have you with us.
It's great to be on, Frank. Always a pleasure.
So in addition to your various other projects, Trevor, you have recently done a list of socialists and communists in the Congress in 2019. I want to talk to you about that group and some of the more prominent among them. But before we do, I wanted to take stock with you, as I did with Dinah, about the president's very strong throwdown with the socialists in the course of his State of the Union address. I take it that you saw it and were as pleased as we were about it.
Yeah, look. I think especially those last few minutes of the speech were terrific. And he made it very clear. He said, you know, America will never go socialist. We were born in freedom and we will live that way. And that was a great challenge to the left because he was looking out at probably 100 socialists right in front of him. You know, and I'm talking senators and congressmen.
Now, that's 100 out of 535. That's a very substantial percentage of the Congress of the United States that you would characterize as socialists or more, worse, I guess, communists. Trevor, when you use that term, are you talking about so-called card-carrying socialists? Are you talking about people who simply self-describe that way? Are you talking about people on the basis of associations and proclivities that you would characterize that way? Give us some definition of your terms here.
Yeah, and that's a fair question. Yeah, well, some of them are card-carrying. Like, obviously, you have members like Rashida Tlaib and Ocasio-Cortez, Jerry Nadler, Jan Schakowsky, Danny Davis. Have all been card-carrying members of Democratic Socialists of America. But what I'm talking about here is really people who have a long-term association and a history of working with, contributing to the programs of, going to meetings with, and generally following along with the Communist Party USA and Democratic Socialists of America, and also organizations like CARE, the Council for American Islamic Relations, which also has a very heavily socialist and Marxist bent as well. So, yeah, I would put about 100 members of the House and 20 to 25 members of the US Senate who are so enmeshed in Marxist organizations or hostile foreign powers or both, they couldn't pass any form of security clearance whatsoever. But the shocking thing is there are no security clearances in the House or the Senate, so they're never called to account.
This is such a stunning statement, and I think most Americans are unaware, Trevor, despite your best efforts, of what the implications of that are. When you say that members, Jerry Nadler is the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, for heaven's sakes. You have Andre Carson, who is a member of senior member of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff. I mean, people like this are people that you would think would be required to have some kind of formal vetting for security purposes, and yet they don't. How is that?
Well, listen, this is I regard as America's Achilles heel. This is your biggest weak point. Because when you join the military in America, you swear an oath to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. But it was decided a long time ago that Congress members were off limits for investigation. The FBI has not investigated Congress members since at least the 1940s and probably before that. So your enemies exploit that. The Communist Party USA has had many of its people in your Congress and still does. They just elected a close supporter of theirs, Kyrsten Sinema, to the US Senate. Raul Grijalva, who heads a very sensitive committee, is a longtime Communist Party supporter, for instance. So, you know, the Islamists, the Russians, the Chinese, the Cubans have a long history of working with people in your country to help elect their sympathizers into your Congress. And they have done a great job of it. And nobody calls them to account.
Yeah, as you mentioned, the oath of office, I think the oath is also one that is taken by members of Congress to a similar effect, you know, against enemies, foreign and domestic. But you're saying, Trevor Loudon, that these are individuals who may well be deeply associated with such enemy organizations and enterprises themselves, and are not held accountable for that, not denied access to sensitive information, including, you know, some of the most sensitive of state secrets. And that the danger, I guess, is that we find, and it's in a way this goes back to Dinah West's excellent book on American betrayal and, of course, your own research, it's kind of off limits to talk about the possibility of domestic enemies, people who are subversive, people who are seeking to undermine our country or overthrow our constitutional republic, for that matter, from within. No?
Well, absolutely. It won't get you invited to the country club. You know, this is, as you say, Frank, it's off limits to talk about this. This is why Dinah West was attacked so viciously over her book, because you're allowed to talk about spies, you're allowed to talk about people who stole secrets, etc., because that's been so well proven with court cases now, you can't argue it. But you're not allowed to talk about agents of influence, high-ranking people in the government who use their influence to affect government policy. But you have at least six or eight Democrats now serving, chairing sensitive committees, none of whom who could pass the most basic background check ever. They wouldn't be allowed to drive a school bus.
As you say, right.
But like Jerry Jerry Nadler has been a card-carrying member of a Marxist group, Democratic Socialists of America. He now heads the Judiciary Committee, the most powerful committee in the Congress, which oversees the FBI. Do you think the FBI is going to investigate Congress members when Jerry Nadler chairs the committee that oversees them?
Yeah, it's in need of that kind of oversight for sure. But I think you're right. The FBI, certainly, as we've seen of late, is unlikely to provide it. So, Trevor, just to bring this sort of to a full circle, the president has laid down the marker that we're not going to become a socialist nation. I think your research strongly suggests that that is exactly what Ocasio-Cortez and Jerry Nadler and Bernie Sanders and over 100 others that you've described have in mind. So what is it that needs to be done, as you see it, to try to ensure that the president's very strong defense of freedom actually prevails in the face of the kind of population of the Congress, both the Senate and the House of Representatives, with people who were clearly opposed to his agenda?
Well, I think there has to be a massive campaign to defund the left, because the left gets a whole bunch of its money from the federal government. And that's one of the things that Reagan did when he got into office. He had a guy who went around defunding all the left-wing programs. Well, that needs to happen again to cut that out of the budget. But you actually need, we need to have a real campaign to actually call out the radicals in Congress. People know about Ocasio-Cortez, but they think she's the only socialist. She is just the tip of the iceberg. And it has to be an actual campaign to highlight the backgrounds of these people, you know, with their communist, their socialist, their Islamist, their, even their terrorist connections in some cases. Because if this was done, the Democrats, you know, and they are the main culprits in this, not the only culprits, they would have to either clean out their party or they would face extinction.
Yeah. And in your analyses, and I really can't speak highly enough about them, enemies within, and Barack Obama, and the enemies within communists, socialists, and progressives in the U.S. Congress, and of course, most recently, Trevor Loudon, your 2019 list of socialists and communists in Congress. This has to begin with us, it seems to me. And as you say, holding the Democrats accountable for cleaning up their house and challenging them if they fail to do so, so as to ensure that we do not face from these enemies within serious subversion and the loss ultimately of our freedoms. Trevor, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll speak with Russ Dallin right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We have with us Russ Dallin, one of the men we turn to with regularity about matters involving our own hemisphere. He is the president and editor-in-chief at the Latin American Herald Tribune. He's also the head of an international investment bank, Caracas Capital Markets. He has spent a lot of time over the years living and working in Venezuela's capital, Caracas. He has of late, however, been monitoring closely what's going on there, mostly, I believe, from Miami and stateside. But Russ, as always, I'm appreciative of your expertise and your sources on what's happening on the ground in Venezuela. It seems to be highly dynamic at last in terms of the possibilities of change there. Give us your current reading on what's happening on the ground and what comes next.
Thank you, Secretary Gaffney. It's always a pleasure to be with you. You have been on the forefront of covering Venezuela over the years and have watched this catastrophe continue to snowball. and brought your listeners basically 50-yard line seats in Super Bowl terms on the battle between democracy and dictatorship going on in the world and in our own backyard, if you will. The situation is, so far, the United States has now deployed its full power of its economic sanctions. We will import no more oil from Venezuela, which is their lifeblood. We have basically made it so while these sanctions come into effect, that any oil that is imported must be paid into a locked account controlled by the Secretary of the Treasury, which will be for the use of the opposition government, which the United States has recognized. In addition, we'll export no diluent, this paint thinner that the Venezuelans need to make their very heavy crude, tar-like crude, if you will, flow through the pipes to get to the ships and have a sellable blend, which is also hurting the Venezuelans. So we have deployed a full complement of economic sanctions against Venezuela last week.
Now, we've been talking about the need for these kinds of actions for quite some time, Russ, you and I, and it's clear that there were very powerful forces at work for not doing this, continuing to do business with the Venezuelan regime and so on. Was the game changer in terms of this that finally there was an opposition figure who had stepped forward to provide a legitimate alternative to Maduro, or was it just the cumulative effect of everything else failing to produce desired results?
It was all of those things. And what has happened was that back in May, when Venezuela and the Maduro regime held a fake election for the presidency, and I say fake election because it was fraudulent from top to bottom, they banned all the opposition leaders from competing, and then they banned the opposition party from competing, which is not exactly free and fair, in addition to all the cheating that goes on. So that was universally condemned around the world, that it would not be recognized. Mr. Maduro's current term expired on January 10th. So when he assumed the mantle for this fake second term on the basis of elections that most of the world, Europe and America, Canada, and most of Latin America, except for the Cuban acolytes in Bolivia and Nicaragua and Cuba, of course, did not recognize, there was a gap in the presidency. According to the Constitution, if their president is unable or unable to serve, and since there is no president, that position would fall on the leader of the National Assembly. The leader of the National Assembly is a 35-year-old young man who grew up and was a co-founder of one of the younger political parties in Venezuela, also co-founded with Leopoldo López, who is one of the great leaders of the opposition, who spent 3 years in prison.
And is still there.
Well, he's under house arrest and gag order, so he can't, or else they're going to drag him back to prison. So, but he's very much in the background, kind of helping call the shots, giving aid and assistance to the young, his name is Juan Guaido, and you can, the UAI spelling is unusual for Americans, so you just think of it as one white dog, if you had to transliterate it into gringo English. So one white dog, Juan Guaido. And he has done a great job working with the United States. As soon as he finally came out and said, well, there's a gap in the presidential, I will accept that. The United States recognized him, as did Canada, as did most of the Lima Group, 15 nations, the most powerful nations in Latin America, the European Parliament, and many of the most of the European nations, from Austria to the UK and France, Sweden even, have recognized Juan Guaido as the interim president, which is what his position is until elections can be called, the interim president of the country. So so now you have a country with two presidents and competing assemblies and competing Supreme Courts. But the U.S. recognizes one is providing all the money from U.S. oil sales and Citgo, by the way, which they have given to control basically of the opposition, which will now control all the Citgo oil infrastructure in the United States, which is in basically 23 states.
It's rather significant. So the Maduro regime is not giving up, needless to say, Russ Dallin. And what is it doing at the moment to try to maintain liquidity or at least some capacity to pay the military or its benefactors sufficiently to ensure their continued loyalty and support?
Everything it can is the short answer to that question, including liquidating its gold reserves, which we have been tracking and following. And we've actually been able to, you know, through shining the light on the cucarachas, if you will, have so far stopped, for example, the export on a Russian plane of $850 million worth of gold. The Dubai investment bank that was brokering that deal withdrew under international condemnation after Senator Marco Rubio, who has been a leading light on this, focused that it was Noor Capital in the UAE and the United Arab Emirates who had chartered this Russian plane to smuggle this gold, or not smother it, but get it out of the country. England has come in and not allowed Venezuela to repatriate $1.2 billion in gold that they held in the Bank of England. And that has also deprived the regime of oxygen, plus the lack of the U.S. market, which is the bulk of where it's most all of its money comes from the U.S. You know, as you and I have spoken of over the years, the United States was the only one keeping the lights on in Venezuela. That has now ceased to be.
So just to cut to the chase, because we're almost out of time, Russ Dahlen, but we have, in other words, a considerable amount of tightening of the screws on the Maduro regime. The hope, I guess, is that he decides to find a safe haven to flee to somewhere, Cuba, Russia, somewhere. What is it that the United States should be doing at this point that it isn't currently doing that might help, particularly with those allies on the ground in the vicinity, notably in Brazil and Colombia, to try to facilitate such a swift transition and end to this horrific suffering in Venezuela?
Well, as you know, we've had economic sanctions on Cuba for 60 years, and there's still a Castro running that country. So economic sanctions by themselves do not work very well against dictatorships in the Cuban mold. And the Cubans are very much involved. The Russians are also rendering aid. As a matter of fact, while Venezuela is starving, Russia, Rosneft's largest oil company, which is majority state-owned, reported yesterday that Venezuela paid them $2.3 billion down on the debt, a $4.6 billion debt, which was really $6 billion that they owed the Venezuelans just last year. So while this country is starving and people are dying, the Russians were still getting their chunk of hide out of this country. But the next thing we're going to do is deliver aid. And that is going to be a divisive thing, because Maduro says, oh, we don't have any problems here. We don't need any aid, and we're going to block it. And he sent troops to the Colombian border and the Brazilian border to block the aid from coming in. So now we're going to see whether the army will remain loyal. And we had to have some defections. The military attaché in Washington has defected. Some generals have defected over the years, but the bulk of the army is staying loyal to the regime, which is the key. But will they take the aid? Because the guys at the bottom, while the generals are making money in narco-trafficking and smuggling and all the other financial things that they're able to do, the privates and sergeants are, their families are starving, they're starving, because they're getting less than $5 a month.
We'll be watching it closely, as will you at the Latin American Herald Tribune. Russ Dahlen, thank you for the work that you do there, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.